I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, the first in a two-part expose of a convicted Hollywood pedophile. Filmmaker Victor Salva is perhaps most well known for writing and directing the Jeepers Creepers franchise, which has been terrifying moviegoers since 2001. The series deals with a supernatural apex predator known as the Creeper. Within the franchise's mythos, this monster hunts down human prey for 23 days every 23 years in order to regenerate itself before going back into a prolonged slumber. This creature has proven popular enough with movie audiences to spawn two sequels, the latest of which, 2017's Jeepers Creepers 3, was given an unusual theatrical re-release for the 2019 Halloween season. But what if the real monster, the real creeper, was the man behind the camera on these films? In 1988, Victor Salva was convicted on charges related to child sexual abuse, specifically lewd and lascivious acts with the 12-year-old star of his debut feature, Clown House. After serving 15 months of a 3-year sentence, Salva kept a low profile, that is until 1995, when he made his official return to filmmaking with the direct-to-video thriller The Nature of the Beast and, controversially, the theatrically released Disney movie Powder. Since then, Salva has maintained a career as a writer and director. In total, Victor Salva has written and directed 10 feature-length films, 9 of which were made after Clown House. Joining us on this edition of Parallax Views is the former child actor who starred in that very movie, Nathan Forrest Winters, to tell his story and the road he took to healing, recovery, and survival. Additionally, Nathan will fill us in on the upcoming documentary about his experiences, The Boy, which, I might add, is due out on October 31st. Before diving into the conversation, I'd like to note that Nathan is also a musician, and as such, composed the music for this upcoming documentary. Nathan has generously permitted me to use said music for this edition of Parallax Views. And with that being said, I present to you a track entitled The Monster, Part 1, from the soundtrack to The Boy. Welcome to Parallax Views, Nathan Forrest Winters.
How are you?
Pretty good, Nathan. This is going to be a pretty, I think, serious conversation. You're a former child actor from the movie Clown House, for folks that may be unfamiliar. You worked with a director by the name of Victor Salva, who is most known today for the Jeepers Creepers franchise. But on the set of Clown House, you had a very dark experience with this Victor Salva fellow, and he ended up in prison for it. But before we get into that, maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about yourself when you were growing up and how you ended up coming in contact with this man, Victor Salva.
Sure. So basically, I grew up in the East Bay area of California, and my mother's very artistic and very talented and very, you know, skilled with her hands as far as crafts go. And Victor, who I'll add, has worked prior to, you know, being a director in Hollywood. All of his jobs leading up to that I know of were involved with children in some way. So
did he work at daycares, I believe, or no?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, that's in fact where we were introduced to him. Is a good friend of my mother's daughter went to this daycare where he worked, and he was talking to her after work one, you know, when she was picking up her daughter one day and explaining to her about this film he was making called Goblin's Gold, about a little boy that meets this goblin in a cave and has this treasure, and you know, and that he was complaining about not having anyone to make props, you know, for the goblin. And so, knowing my mother's skill, she basically said, you know, well, I got somebody that would be perfect for you. And that's how my family was introduced to Victor. And so that was about 6 years old at that time. And he spent the first year or so, you know, like a traditional pedophile, by grooming my family and I, first developing my parents' trust, you know, and then developing my love and my trust as well, so he could, you know, exploit it basically later.
Did he try to sort of take up a role as almost like a father figure? I've heard you say in other interviews that you may have had some issues with your father, and that Victor tried to take that role in a way.
In many regards, he did. You know, my dad worked a lot, and we didn't have much of a relationship when I was a kid. And so I was kind of one of those boys seeking a, you know, positive male role model. And that's like a walking target for predators of children. They see that a mile away. And so, you know, I was the perfect target for Victor, and he used that to his full advantage.
So that first year, there was nothing necessarily sexual at first. How does that develop? Or was there things early on?
Yeah, it's something that in my case, Victor was very, very smooth and very, you know, master manipulator. And once he knew that he had, that's the biggest issue with children that are abused in this kind of a setting, where it's done over years and years and years, is that it's usually not violent. It's usually not, they don't use horrific threats in a lot of cases. It's somebody that you love and the child loves and trusts. And so by developing that, he was able to start abusing me. It was a very smooth transition, where it was comments. And then, you know, one of the first times that I can remember was, you know, making a mock loin, you know, like a faux loincloth for me out of two bandanas. And that's when the first time I remember him, like, kind of groping and touching me on my genitalia.
It's extremely disturbing to talk about. I guess that's an important point, though, because I think there's a lot of this talk of, when I was growing up, it was all about stranger danger, but in a lot of cases, it's people that become close with the families and close with their children that, you know, that lead to these sort of incidents happening.
Yeah, absolutely. It's more rare that you hear of a case of it being a stranger than it being someone that's directly related to the child or a close family friend.
So Victor comes in your life, I think you said it around 6 years old. Is that close? I don't believe that's close to the time that Salva ended up doing Clown House.
No. Clown House was done in 89. And I guess, well, that was when it was released. But I believe we filmed it in, it was 87. Because I was, 87. Because we filmed it a month before my birthday. And I turned 12 that year. So it was definitely, it was 87 that we filmed it. And that was the end of the abuse. The abuse had been occurring since, you know, within the first year. So somewhere in between 6 and 7 is when he started abusing me. And it didn't end until, like I said, a month before my 12th birthday.
Okay. Wow. So how do you end up working on Clown House? Or is there anything else you want to say before we move on to your experience on the set of Clown House?
Just that he, you know, there's no proof of it, but I want to stress that I wasn't the only child. I wasn't the only boy that he babysat by any means. He had several other boys that would come and stay the night being babysat. So,
he got so close with your family that he was babysitting.
Oh, yeah, to the point where, like, I would go to his house for the weekend.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. He was like the, you know, for lack of better terms, he's like the Disneyland dad, you know, the one that, you know, I would see a couple times a week and would take me out somewhere really nice, take me to the movies anytime something cool came out that I wanted to see, you know, would buy me the things that my parents wouldn't, kind of thing, you know what I mean? He was that kind of an uncle, right, in quotations, right?
And so... You know for a fact, I mean we can't talk about if Salva necessarily abused anyone else. We don't have maybe necessarily hard evidence.
No, there's no hard evidence.
But we do know that he was babysitting other children. You can say that definitively.
I can say that definitively. Absolutely. He was babysitting other boys, not children, boys specifically.
So how does the movie Clown House come about? Wasn't there a short film that he did initially that ended up?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it was he had written a script called Something in the Basement, and it's about a young boy about my age at the time, I think 9-ish, that lives with his mother and grandfather, and his older brother is off in the war. And so this film is basically, the premise is, it's just this perpetual dream, never ending dream, where I'm constantly waking up, and so you never know if I'm dreaming or if I'm awake. And it's all about the anxiety and the stress and the fear that this boy has about his brother dying in war. And it's personified around this monster in the basement. And so I literally had to beg him to let me audition. And so he finally broke down and, you know, gave in and let me audition for it. And I won the role out of like 20 other boys. And
is that something you wanted to do growing up? Was to be in acting?
Definitely, yeah. When I was 5 years old, if, you know, they do, some adults will do, they ask you, what do you want to be when you grow up? And my answer was always, I wanted to be a father and I wanted to be famous. So, you know, it was definitely something that has been in me since I can remember. You know, I started playing music really early, like 3. So I've always had that kind of performer personality and drive.
And Salva was reticent at first about having you in the movie?
Yeah, he was reserved. He didn't want to hurt my feelings if I wasn't good enough to, you know, be cast. So at least that was what he told me. I don't know if that was a manipulation or if that was true. Honestly, at this point, I can't. It's not something that I've given much thought of, you know.
That's fair. Is this when you get cast in Clown House, or is this...
That was Something in the Basement.
Okay.
So I was cast in Something in the Basement in the lead role, and one of my co-stars in the film was actually Brian McHugh, who plays Jeffrey in Clown House, the middle brother. And so I believe Brian had originally auditioned for my role, the lead role, and ended up that Victor liked him enough to keep him as the co-star, who was my best friend in the film. He played my best friend. And so that film was entered into a film festival. I think it was Sony Film Festival in San Francisco, where Francis Ford Coppola was on the panel of judges, and it won first place for its category. And Coppola approached Victor and wanted to work with him again. So Victor went home and wrote Clown House with me in the starring role as Casey and Brian McHugh in the co-starring role as Jeffrey, my brother.
Okay, okay. I think we'll be coming back around to Coppola in a bit, because he's a very key figure in a lot of this, in my view.
Yeah, he's very prominent in Victor's career.
So I want to talk, though, about... Are you willing to talk a little bit about Clown House and what happened? I don't want to push or be... I don't want to drudge up anything, necessarily. I'm trying honestly, to be careful about this.
Yeah, honestly, I went through 6 years of therapy where I was... you know, taught to talk about it, which is probably one of the biggest, like the backbone, I guess is what you would call it, of my desire and my will, you know, to keep the truth out there and to protect, you know, and educate people on the truth of the fact that, you know, pedophilia is rampant in our society. And it's in my opinion, in most recent years, last few years, is seriously starting to take over and become an accepted thing in our society. And I with my last breath, will not allow that without saying something. You know, I will stand up and speak for those that don't have the strength or courage to at this point. So you can pretty much ask me anything.
With that being said, maybe you could sum up what happened on the set of this movie Clown House, which as a side note, this movie to me, I can't even watch it. I've seen the first 5 minutes. I know you're it's very disturbing, those first 5 minutes, in my view.
Absolutely.
And also just the idea of it's basically a movie where kids are terrorized by these people from a mental asylum that break out and are uh-huh. dressed as clowns. I mean, just the idea of these children being terrorized, I mean, it's disturbing to me, especially given who Victor Salva is. And I know there was, I guess, a sort of gratuitous shot of you in the beginning of the movie, too, that's very, I don't know, it just feels like a very creepy thing.
The entire, the opening of that film is a pedophile's wet dream. I mean, I'll lay it out for you. It opens up with me waking up in the middle of the night and walking down the hall, having my attention drawn towards the far window. So I walk down this long hall, come to the window, and this flyer for the circus comes and slaps the window right in front of me. And it does this tight shot that where the clown's face gets all evil and maniacal, and the fire from the flame blower down at the bottom like gets big and goes all around the clown's face, and I urinate myself. And then I bolt upright, and I, you know, obviously was dreaming. And under the covers, you see that I'm taking off my pajama bottoms and I throw them on the floor. And then it goes to a shot of my pajama bottoms, I think, or something. And then the very next scene is Brian McHugh, who's the middle brother, who's, I believe, you know, at that point was 13 or so. He is in a tank top, white tank top, like wife beater, you know, for lack of better terms again, and a pair of tidy whities, you know. And he's coming down the hall and he goes to open his brother's door and you hear this, "Hey, stay the hell out of my room." And then Brian returns with, "That thing is going to fall off," and goes to wake me up. And so he goes and he kicks my pants that are wet and says, "Again, Case." And I kind of get up, and then here comes, you know, Sam Rockwell enters the room, throwing on like a button down shirt and his tidy whities and tank top shirt. And there's this whole argument about, you know, how he's going to beat him up if he ever walks in his room again. And it's this whole joke about the younger brother catching the older brother masturbating in the morning. And then I get out of bed bare-assed and put on my pair of underwear. And that's the opening to this film.
So if you can, for my listeners that maybe it's very odd. People know about Jeepers Creepers. People know about Rosewood Lane. They know about all these movies that come out now that Victor Salva does, but a lot of people don't know about Clown House. Mm-hmm. What happened on the set of Clown House? I know I'm asking that very bluntly.
On the set, I can't say that. It was a very tight, closed set, so it wasn't as if he was abusing me in public. But one of the main reasons that my mother pushing me so hard for the truth at that point was because she had so many cast members and crew members on that film during the filming of it come up to her and say, "What is the deal?" Because whatever Victor's and Nathan's relationship is completely inappropriate, you know. In between scenes and takes, I would be running and jumping in his lap and, like, crying. And it was just this whole very unnatural and, you know, not the norm for a movie set between a relationship between a director and their child actor. So it was enough to raise suspicions in a lot of the cast and crew. So that's really, I mean, much more than that, I can't say. There were times where, you know, I would have to, because we filmed part of it again at Coppola's house in Napa Valley, California. The whole exterior of that film, any exterior shots of our house was actually, that's Coppola's house. We used his property for various sets and scenes in the film. And so that's Napa's, you know, several hours away from where I grew up in Concord in the Bay Area. And so there were times where I'd have to stay the night with Victor in a hotel for a week during the filming. And was I abused during those times? Absolutely. Was it on the set of Clown House? No.
Okay. And my understanding is that a lot of things were filmed by Victor for his like private collection, essentially.
Yeah, that had been going on for years. I mean, ever since he basically had a camera, a video camera set up at home, like that was something he did.
So your mom is sort of pushing you a little bit to open up. How does it come about that you sort of fess up to what's been happening with Salva to your mother, and how does it snowball from there into this criminal case that landed Salva in jail?
I didn't enjoy the things that Victor was doing to me. By that point, I'd become completely sick of his shit, just to put it lightly. So she had been asking, and one day I don't know, something in me snapped. And so, because he made me feel like an object a lot in the last couple of years of the abuse, you know. It's like there was very little, like, the tenderness that was there before where I could cry about how mean my dad was or how bad school was, or, you know, because I was picked on in school a lot too. So I was already a victim when Victor met me. And so, but that had all surpassed, and it was just about me being an object of his, you know, lust. And so I don't know exactly what happened, but I went to my mom and I told her that I had a secret that I had to tell her. And I started telling her some of the stuff that Victor had been doing to me. And they went to the police, and the police did a sting on Victor and caught him on his way up to Coppola's house for, you know, post-production. And they found stacks of videotapes and stacks of photo albums full of naked boys and half-naked boys, and clips from magazines and newspapers where boys are modeling underwear, and, you know, his collection of child pornography that he'd been making. And he was arrested on 11 counts. And was bailed out instantly by Coppola, and had a very high-priced lawyer, you know, a big shot lawyer from San Francisco working for Coppola, you know, was his lawyer. And here we are, this little, my dad owned his own sign shop. And so we're like this, you know, poor, you know, lower middle class family, blue collar family, being sued for millions of dollars by one of the biggest names in Hollywood. Because I told my mom the truth.
What were they suing for? Was it like a breach of contract?
Absolutely. $5 million lawsuit.
And this is Coppola doing the lawsuit?
Yes.
Okay, okay. Was there any ramifications to that? I think Connor, the director of The Boy, he recently told me that you were basically forced to do the overdubbing for Clown House, and this was after everything had transpired.
That was after Victor had been arrested. I had to go back to Coppola's house for a month and overdub the entire film, because the cameras that we used were loaned to us, and they were the same cameras actually used for American Graffiti by George Lucas. And they're from the 70s. They were like so loud, you know, just clack, 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 like so loud that any audio was garbage. So every bit of audio had to be overdubbed. And so after the fact of Victor being arrested and me being this treacherous, horrible little tattletale, I had to go back and do all the overdubbing at Coppola's house for a month, because that would have been a breach of contract. And like, it was a mess.
Did you ever have any contact with Coppola? Like, did you ever speak to him? Did he apologize for any of this? Was there any reconciliation?
There was no apologies. The only time I met Coppola three times, and that was, before the filming, and then twice on the set at his house. He was home. Other than that, what I got for telling my mom the truth was, when the movie was finally finished, it was never released to theaters. It was went straight to like premium channels, like Showtime and HBO and stuff. And they did one theatrical premiere in downtown San Francisco, where it was shown on screen only one time, and every cast and crew member was invited except for me.
Did any of your other cast members have similar issues with Salva, people like Brian, or was it just you?
It was just me. Brian, that's something I'm not necessarily at liberty to get into, because we do have some audio of Brian in the film, and I'm sure Connor would be like outside of his skin if I was to like give away those spoilers. So
I asked because Connor wanted me to break this, actually.
Okay. Well then, yes, we have audio of Brian, and he doesn't remember being abused, but there were videotapes with Brian found. One in particular was him taking a shower. Victor had set up a camera in a laundry basket full of clothes.
Ooh. Okay. Yeah, this is, like I said, it's very disturbing stuff. So, Salva, there's also the question of how long he served in prison. I think he was supposed to serve 3 years, but he did not serve a full 3 years. It may have been more than 3 years. I don't know if you can correct me on that.
He was, again, he was charged with 11 counts of child molestation and, however they word it in, lawyer speak, but, and was convicted of four because of a shady plea bargain done by his attorney and my attorney. And he was sentenced to 3 years, of which he served, I think, 15 months in a treatment center. He didn't go to prison. He went to like a treatment center.
You know, that's interesting, because I've heard Salva talk about how when he made this movie called The Nature of the Beast in 1995, and he said it was based on his experiences in prison and how horribly he was treated in prison, and he would get beat up in prison. But you're saying he actually went to, what amounts to a psychiatric ward.
Well, it was definitely, I'm sure it was a, I don't know if it was maximum security, but it was definitely a high security facility designed more for treatment. So it wasn't as if he was behind bars in stripes with a bunch of, murderers and thugs. He didn't go to a prison like that. He went to a treatment facility. So.
Okay. Okay. That answers my question. I'm not saying that he couldn't have been abused in a facility like that or anything like that. I'm just clarifying these things. A lot of this is really, it's difficult to hash out. I'm curious, do you think Salva, I think he's often said that he always felt like an outsider. He was picked on growing up. Do you think he may have gone through abuse? I mean, I know you've said that, you know, at one point, you know, even a monster like Salva had to be an innocent child at one point.
That's actually, you know, something that I liked it. I feel it's a necessary, it's very necessary to stress this point that for me, I'm looking for a solution, some way to protect our children without having the blood on my hands of these monsters and these predators, because I don't believe that's the way. I don't believe killing them is the way. I don't think throwing them into a prison where they become better equipped are able to network with other predators or whatever, you know, I don't think that's necessarily the way either. I'm looking for solutions that will solve this. And, you know, I think that that solution is in a place of compassion and where we remember about the fact that Victor was once a little boy being abused, because he personally told me this while he was abusing me, that, you know, about the person that abused him, which was a relative. You know, I can't, it's not my story to tell.
I understand. So, I understand.
So I can't divulge too much or give too much energy into it, I guess. But I want people to remember that fact when they want to, you know, because people want to sit there and go, oh, I'll just kill him. If you were my kid, I would have killed him. I would have cut his nuts off or whatever the typical, you know, emotion comes from hearing something like that, because I'm a father. So I understand where that rage and that pain and that anger comes from, but that's not where the solution is. So I make it clear to, you know, make a point to remind people that he was once a little boy being abused. He grew up to be a monster. I didn't. Many, many others don't grow up to be monsters. In fact, the majority don't. Because the truth is victims and survivors far outnumber the monsters and the predators. And that's something that we have to remember. That's, you know, that they, the someone like Victor has probably, you know, over 150 victims in a lifetime.
Well, the thing that gets me is after his arrest and all of this goes down, he eventually resurfaces in Hollywood, making a Disney movie called Powder. Before we get into that, I mean, you protested that movie. Did you ever get any apology from Salva?
Never.
I think that says it all. Do you know much about how he manages to resurface and how did this, I mean, how does he end up working with Disney? I mean, I'm assuming there could have been kids on that set. I mean, it's pretty scary to think about.
One of the biggest reasons, you know, that I protested that film was because there were reports coming back of dailies and how Victor could often be seen dining at the children's table, and there was dogs and children running around the set. If that answers your question.
Yes. Yes. It does.
Mary Steenburgen went so far at defending Victor as to say that she would allow him to babysit her children.
Who is Mary?
Mary Steenburgen is the actress in Powder that plays the social worker or whatever that discovers Sean Patrick Flannery's character, Powder.
Okay, okay. And the movie itself is also... I find it very disturbing, the little clips I've seen of it, because it's about young boys, and I mean I believe there's even some scenes of abuse in it, in showers and whatnot.
One of the ending scenes in that film, and I didn't watch this film, I was kind of operating from a place where you are right now as far as like seeing clips and having things told to me, up until we filmed The Boy, Connor and I. He had me sit down and watch Powder and Jeepers Creepers 1 and 2. And so I wasn't aware until just a couple years ago of just how twisted this film is, especially to be a film produced by, you know, Disney. Towards the end of the film, Powder's walking through the gym, and some of the boys are in the gym playing basketball, topless, let me add. And Powder notices this boy giving himself like an herbal essence, like hairgasm type sponge bath in a sink with his tank top, right? And there's these long, drawn out scenes of very sensual and like slow motion and steamy, you know, this boy giving himself a sponge bath in the sink, and Powder's like watching it intently until the boys playing basketball notice him watching this other boy. And so they take him outside, and this is what they do. They chastise him, obviously, for looking at the other boy, and then rip off his clothes to see if he's hairless everywhere, and then push him into a mud puddle. So there's scenes of these boys ripping off Powder's clothes. It shows Sean Patrick Flannery's bare ass being pushed into a mud puddle. And these are supposed to be high school boys.
Well, you know, I guess after Powder, there's a lot more scrutiny on Salva, I would assume. I don't know how the producers of Powder reacted to all of this. I don't know if you have any insights on that, do you?
Yeah, they went so far as the representative for Disney went so far as to lie bold faced and say that he wasn't aware of Victor's past until halfway through production, and that, and then trivialized it by saying that it was a one-time inappropriate touching incident between an adult man and a minor.
You know, I've heard that Coppola has defended Salva by saying he was himself like a boy at that time when it all happened.
That our age difference was, you know, very minor, and he was practically a boy himself when, in fact, he was 29 at the time of his arrest, and I was 11.
So, did you get support during the protest stuff? I've always been curious about that. I assume a lot of people, you know, would understand why you were so angry about it. Did the protests work out well, or do you feel it was a bust?
No, I feel like, you know, if I had to put a number to it, I would say probably it's anywhere from 60 to 65, 40, 35, you know, that kind of ratio as far as people that were behind what I was doing and supportive, as opposed to the people that, you know, would say things like he served his debt and, you know, he should be allowed to make movies and what I'm doing is completely odious and I should be ashamed of myself. So there's a fair amount of support. The biggest thing back then, you know, there wasn't internet like there is now. And the press, the media just pretty much, you know, I was like the next flavor of the week. They chewed me up, spit me out, and went on to the next thing as if I, you know, which is a difficult thing to accept and deal with, you know, being as how much it cost me emotionally and everything, you know, to be that poster boy and to go out there and to, you know, because prior to this, if you were to look up, prior to me coming forward and protesting Powder the way that I did, no other man had ever come forward like that. So willingly and with my head held high, laying down the truth, you know, and that was a first. That was something like, you know, there's been so many incidences and cases of boys coming forward and, you know, with the Catholic Church and colleges and schools and on and on and on. And that in part has a lot to do with my protest of Powder, because prior to that, it wasn't something that the boys talked about or did.
On that note, I wanted to also, I believe your mother has also spoken out a lot when questioned by media about this, and I really want to applaud her for that. In addition, I wanted to say, you know, I think one of the problems, and maybe it's changing now with the Catholic crisis, but I feel like young boys and men are stigmatized far too much for speaking out when they are victimized and abused.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's something that now, just to jump forward a little bit, I've been asked before about my stand on the Me Too movement. And
I wanted to ask you about this, actually.
Yeah. Where I stand with that is I think it's great. You know, more power to those victims and survivors that are finding their courage and their voice again. I disagree wholeheartedly with the division that they create, that it's only about women, and that's only, you know, and I understand that women have been done really wrong in society throughout history. And I believe that they should have equality, and they should, you know, I'm all for the empowerment of women. But when it comes to victimization, it doesn't matter the gender. We all have to experience and go through those same things and fight those same demons on a daily. And there shouldn't be any division, because the only way to overcome any kind of foe, now I'm just putting in these terms for you know, to easily visualize this metaphorically, that, you know, there's more of us than there are of them. And if we can learn to work together and unite, we can make it safer, and we can save countless children from having to go through what we've gone through. But divided, we will fall. And that's the only issue I've really ever had with Me Too, is division.
Well, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, I think there's a lot of people in Me Too that would agree wholeheartedly with you.
I do. I've talked to, you know, a handful of people that are directly involved with that movement, and that they feel the same way that I do as well, that it's not about division, it's about unity. So I don't, you know, I just, again, I applaud their movement. I think that it's great, and I think that it needs to be addressed, and people need to stop taking this mentality of, you know, like a blind eye and a deaf ear to these issues, because they're very real and they're very prominent. You know, they're in fact like choking us out, in my opinion, that we, you know, it's time to like put an end to this shit, you know, and start fighting together to protect each other.
Well, if we could, I wanted to back up briefly, and we will move on to the issue, because I think it's worth talking about the issue of healing and surviving. But I wanted to ask you two more questions that are related to sort of Hollywood and the film industry and all these things revolving around the case. The first was, we talked a little bit about Francis Ford Coppola. He sued for breach of contract over Clown House. I guess the argument was that you guys were interfering in the production of the film. Is that correct? Or
yes. So yes, to put it simply, it was a breach of contract that they were suing us for.
Okay. And I guess the only other thing in regards to Coppola is that people should know that Coppola, through his studio, American Zoetrope, basically has kept Victor Salva afloat, especially with the Jeepers Creepers films, this whole time, essentially.
Absolutely. I believe that Zoetrope's been distributing his films all along, too. So, yeah, Coppola's been his in bed with him since Clown House and hasn't gone away.
And I guess the only other thing, and then we can move on to different areas, is I've had listeners that wanted me to ask you about Rose McGowan, a prominent figure in Me Too, who was actually in a Victor Salva film in the later half. I believe it was between 2013 and 2015. I could be wrong. The movie was called Rosewood Lane. She claims to have not known about who Salva was and his history. What do you make of Rose McGowan? Because I've heard on one end that she's a defender of Salva, but now she knows more about Salva, so she's not a defender. What is your take on that whole thing?
I think that her statements have been very uneducated, and, you know, simply put, it's a cop-out. Like, she has no real regard towards me whatsoever or what I went through, and just wants to brush it aside, kind of thing. So it makes her look bad. I believe it makes her seem very uneducated to me, that she obviously hasn't done research. And to be involved in Me Too the way she is, that to me looks really, really bad. And that she should probably just not say anything. Because it's more of like a slap in the face what she said than it would be for her to have no comment.
Well, with all that being said, I wanted to move on to the issue of healing and survival. What do you have to say about the topic of sort of bringing about healing and surviving? Because, you know, I'm one of these people, I don't like overusing the word victim. I like the word survivor much more. I kind of want your thoughts on how people can heal from these things and how we can help people survive incidents like this, because I mean, Salva is just one of many.
Yes. I think that the main aspect of it is breaking the silence. Because once the silence is broken and you talk about it, and any survivor will know exactly what I'm saying right now, that getting that out is elemental and crucial in the journey to becoming a survivor from being a victim. There's so many aspects and facets to it, you know, that we obviously don't have time to get into all of them, but you know, it takes a lot to just do that first thing, you know, to break the silence, to tell somebody, and you get it out there. And once you do that, it becomes easier. And that weight that you've been dragging around your entire life becomes lighter and lighter and lighter. And the other facets, the other things that, you know, keep you a victim and prevent you from crossing that threshold into becoming a survivor, is something that it happens on a daily. It's because when you're a victim, you allow yourself to be victimized, and a survivor can recognize that and put an end to it before it happens, before you're victimized. So it's really learning a preventative maintenance, which is, you know, very important in all levels of this abuse. So, you know, preventative maintenance is for the parents, for, you know, I mean, really any adult that is not a predator, it's good for them to have the education and to know the information and to know what the signs are of abuse, to know how to pick out predators and look for signs of, you know, someone that is going to be preying on a child or someone else. You know, that to me is one of the biggest things that we could do. When I say unity, that's what I mean by fighting together, is learning and teaching each other how to stop this before it happens, instead of dealing with the aftermath and dealing with, you know, the pain and the trauma of abuse. Because it's not just as if I was the only one that was traumatized. My entire family was traumatized by this. And so, you know, really the biggest part of healing is being able to talk about it and being able to share it and being able to educate people. And so someone that doesn't have any idea, that's never been victimized, has no idea of what it's like or what someone goes through, can have an idea. And that will, and, you know, in turn spark that part of that person to abandon the mentality that we seem to have adopted, which is not my child, not my problem. You know, that is not going to get us anywhere. It doesn't matter if it's your child. It's your responsibility as a human being, adult, to protect children. Because by protecting the children, you're protecting the future as well. You know? So to me, that's one of the biggest things. And healing, me, you know, music, luckily I found music at 15, 16. I found music and started playing and writing music and poetry. And that, for me, was the medium that helped me to find that voice that could not be silenced, that I can say, when I put a pen to a paper, I can say anything I want. And, you know, that was big to me. That was huge to be able to get that shit out as a teenager, going through all the regular things a teenager goes through, you know. And I encourage people to speak about it, to find somebody that they can talk to about it, and to look for those avenues and those, you know, those things that will bring them joy and healing through whatever process it is for them, whether it's, you know, painting or, you know, whatever it could be. It could be archery. It could be, you know, anything that you are able to release some of that through a healthy and, you know, productive way is what I encourage. But the first thing is to break the silence. The second part is taking action.
Well, you know, another thing I wanted to ask you in that regard, I mean, there's a lot more focus on issues related to sexual abuse right now in light of the Jeffrey Epstein case and NXIVM. Although I sometimes feel as if people are only focusing on, you know, these elite members of society, sort of powers that be that are engaged in abuse. But this happens at all kinds of different levels. And we shouldn't just look at victims of people like Victor Salva or an Epstein, because there's other victims as well. We all have to, as you said, stand together and show unity.
Yes. Yeah. It's, again, it's one of those things that mine is not a normal case in the sense that it's not, first of all, my case is completely not unique. The only thing that makes it stand apart is the fact that I'm tied in with Hollywood. And so, you know, it's got that dark side of Hollywood appeal to it. But the fact is that most of these cases are going on at home, you know, where it's an uncle or it's a dad or stepdad or mom, you know, for that matter. Or close family friends, so it's considered to be like an uncle. And we need to give them the voice, the victims. They need to feel like it's safe for them to come forward and break their silence and to stop the abuse. They have to feel like that they're safe, that there's a place for them to do that, you know. And that's another part of my healing process, and sharing that process with everyone is you know, I am aspiring and working towards a nonprofit organization, and my main goal is to unite the rest of the nonprofit organizations and these people, the movements like Me Too, and to unite them all together so that it's one big network working together to prevent it and to help those and the safety of breaking their silence and the healing that comes afterwards, a place to do that through the networking of these organizations and these movements.
Well, you know, just to shift gears for a second, I know you wanted to talk about this. You have a band called The Seven Stone, and the is spelled with a seven for the T. I wanted to ask you about that band, the soundtrack, and also why is seven sort of your calling card? I'm just curious.
Basically, the seven comes from a Native American ceremony called Sweat Lodge. And the way that I was taught, we bring in seven stones for each four rounds. So the total of 28 stones in the lodge by the fourth round. And each one of those seven stones represents the directions, which would be east, south, west, north, above, which is the universe, you know, and below, the earth mother. And the seven stone is the within stone. And for me, the music is the within stone.
And I guess, how would you describe your music? What are you trying to accomplish with it? And then we can talk maybe briefly about the soundtrack to The Boy, because it's really powerful.
Thank you. Music is, again, it's been my healing process. It's been my canvas for the journey in my life, which is, you know, no different than anyone else. Really just, you know, becoming a man and learning about becoming an adult and the things that I've learned. That's the, you know, what I like to pass on in my lyrics is the things that I've learned and these sort of truths and secrets that we all seek in our lives about ourselves and about humans and about existence. And, you know, it's a very spiritually driven and, a very emotionally driven music. And so, you know, I just, it's always been a calling to me to, as a writer. I started writing at 14 and I haven't put the pen down since. And so as a writer, I just, you know, I feel very strongly that as a species, we have always documented our existence, whether it was cave drawings or, you know, scripture or poetry or music. We've always documented our progression and our existence as a species. And to me, it's very romantic and it's a very powerful tool and can have a lot of influence. And any influence that I would have, I want to be helpful and positive and healing. And so it's very, you know, it's some deep stuff.
How would you describe the music? It's sort of I think it has sort of an ambient / acoustic vibe.
Definitely. I've played in bands and done electric music. I've done, you know, like hardcore and screaming and, like, you know, I've done all sorts of different music. But for me, ultimately, when I approach a song and I'm writing a song, I want to be able to pick it up in any setting on an acoustic guitar. And it's all driven by an acoustic sort of foundation. But I do electronic music and all sorts of stuff, too.
Well, it sort of brings us around to the soundtrack, which I'm really impressed by the soundtrack to The Boy. There's four tracks, and I like the names for each of them. The Monster Part 1, The Monster Part 2, The Silenced. There's that term silence coming up again, and The Survivor. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the process and what this music means to the movie, because I know it's very important to you, that soundtrack.
You know, it's really organic. Most of the music was written over a 2-week period to film it. When I flew to Virginia, where Colin is, and we sat in a hotel room for 2 weeks together, and that was the process of making this film. And during the down times when we were kind of just hanging out and had the TV on or something, and you know, weren't necessarily filming anything, I would be on my laptop and be working on score. And everything that I wrote was all with just visuals in my head of what I saw this film being. Like, since we were in the process of filming it, I didn't have any visuals to go by other than what we were doing. And so it was very natural. And, you know, it's the kind of songwriting that I really love, where the songs just write themselves. You know, I get on the instrument and just it all just channels and pours through fluently and naturally. And I don't have to try to force any kind of a circle into a square, so to speak. That's really the process. And it. And then once the film was cut, Connor sent it to me, and I just added the score and did my best to, keep in mind that I didn't want to step on any of his toes and any of his footage. And so it's very subtle in the film. And, a lot of times you might not necessarily even know that it's there, but it definitely adds ambience and it emotionally, it drives the film in a lot of ways. It was like a perfect mirror visuals with my auditory. It was, you know, something that I'm very proud of.
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting too, because even in the really dark songs, like the two parts of The Monster, there's these moments of light that shine through. It really balances the light and the darkness a lot, the soundtrack.
Yeah, it definitely was something that I wanted, that was a point I wanted to make with the score as well, was that throughout every song you'll hear some sort of a backwards track, and that for me symbolizes this backwards idea of love, because I do, and that, you know, maybe necessarily he didn't think that he was abusing me, and that it was good, it was what it was. Okay, I think in the monster's mind it's not abuse, okay, but so backwards compared to what love truly is, because of the manipulation, the lies, the complete exploitation of the child's feelings. It's very backwards. So in every song, there is a backwards track somewhere within that song playing. But there's also, and it doesn't matter if it's the boy or if it's the monster track, it has an element of sadness and beauty, which, you know, speaks for itself. It symbolizes the fact that Victor is still a human and was once a boy and, you know, was being abused, and there's still that element of him in there that we have to keep in mind at all times, but it's very overpowering with the darkness and the viciousness of the monster. So in his tracks, you know, the monster's tracks, it's still there, but it's very much overpowered by the will of the monster. And so that was something that I really wanted to express and convey through the music.
Well, you know, I guess before we close out, I want to ask you, you know, there's a lot of people that really love and grew up on the Jeepers Creepers franchise. And I want you to give your say. What do you have to say to those people that, you know, maybe like Victor Salva's movies? I know you've said that it's not really about whether you like his movies or not. It's about you don't want him working with children. You don't want it to happen again.
Absolutely. That's all it's ever been about for me, is that I'm not here to stop him from working or making films. What I'm here to do is, you know, point out and remind everyone of what he's done, so that they know when they're putting money into his pockets that he is potentially going to molest more boys, because he can't stop himself. He is. I know this from my experience with 6 years being abused by this man. I can say I've been intimate with his inner thinking, and they need to know. They need to know what he did and what he has the potential to do again, and make the decision for themselves whether they want to support that or not. You know, and I'll say this quickly, that, you know, all I've done is want to remind people of what he's done and have him follow the law, which means he's not allowed around anyone under the age of 18.
Right. He is a registered sex offender.
Absolutely. He's not allowed around anyone under the age of 18. And that's all I've ever asked. His film sets have a strict regulation, and they follow that law. That's it. That's what I've asked, period.
Well, I always like to end each edition of Parallax Views on a positive note. I know that's very hard to do with such a dark topic, but if there's any, you know, positive thoughts you can give about healing, how we can help people become survivors, anything like that, and also you can plug the documentary and let my listeners know when The Boy is going to be available.
I totally agree on ending on a positive. I think that's you know, a great stance to take and something to do. My positive contribution is that it gets better, and that it is not all abuse out there. And as dark and as bleak as it may seem, there's always a dawn. No matter how dark the night gets, there's always a dawn. And that can be in your life as well. That you have to remember that there should be no permanent solutions for temporary problems, because there's always a dawn. And we always can find the strength to pick ourselves up and trudge on. And, you know, that's what I've done throughout my life, throughout all the trials. There's been some dark, dark moments, and I've gone through them, and I'm no different than anyone else. So, you know, part of that for me is making this film and being able to share it with any and all that want to accept it and want to, you know, take from it what I intended to give, which is my personal testimony of my journey to survivor and the things that I went through to get here, and how it's no different than anyone else, whether it's child abuse or cyberbullying or whatever the case may be. You know, and we'll be releasing the first segment of the film, will be available October 31st this year.
Well, I really hope that my listeners will check out the upcoming documentary, The Boy. I think it's very important. You know, it's time for the dams to be blown open on not on all forms of abuse that we see in society, and I think we're really getting close to breaking the dam, so to speak.
I agree. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to come and be on your show and say my say.
Well, thank you again, Nathan, for coming on Parallax Views and being so open, sharing your experiences.
All right, thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. In part two of our expose of convicted Hollywood pedophile Victor Salva, we'll be hearing from Connor Fraser, the young filmmaker who took it upon himself to tell Nathan's story in the documentary The Boy. On that episode, you will also hear a Parallax Views exclusive, namely the brief audio testimony of Brian McHugh, another former child actor who co-starred with Nathan in Clown House. I'm going to bypass my usual Patreon fundraising spiel and instead close out the show with another musical track by Nathan Forrest Winters and his band, The Seven Stone, entitled The Boy.